From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Dixon man receives the military's third highest award for bravery. Also, biocremation. A lawmaker says it's an environmentally friendly way to dispose of remains and wants to make it legal in California. And a world-famous modern classical music group prepares to celebrate the 75th birthday of Nevada County composer Terry Riley. First, Sacramento City Council passed a tough budget last night and resoundingly rejected the latest strong mayor proposal. On the budget, the council closed a $43 million shortfall with 100 layoffs and service cuts, but more layoffs could come if the city and unions can't agree on labor concessions. As for strong mayor, the council rejected the latest proposal 7-2. Specifically, they voted against directing the city attorney to draft a strong mayor measure for the November ballot, and this was a defeat for Mayor Kevin Johnson, who's been campaigning to give the office of mayor more powers. We put calls through to 5 city council members this morning. One of them joins us. He's Steve Cohn. Steve Cohn, welcome back to Insight.
Well, good morning.
Well, there must have been a whole lot of tough decisions to be made in a budget that had a $43 million shortfall. How did you approach it?
Well, you're right. It was a tough budget in particular because this comes on top of 2 prior budgets where we had to make a lot of cuts. So what we had to do was come up with really structural changes that would ensure that we're not just fixing a one-time problem, but more on an ongoing basis. So we worked with the city manager to try to plug the holes really with 4 different ways. One was to eliminate virtually all vacancies so that we no longer carry positions on the books when we know we can't fill them. That's just to be more transparent so it's more obvious what we really have in the way of positions. Second is we did have to make significant reductions. We went through a process to determine what's really mandatory, essential versus what's more discretionary, and we did make cuts in both types of programs, but obviously targeted more the discretionary, whereas the mandatory, we were just looking how to be more efficient. And then we're looking for labor concessions, particularly from the non-public safety personnel who have not yet made concessions the way police and fire did last year. And then finally, part of the budget, we did use one-time resources, a little over $10 million, or a quarter of the budget gap, to try to prevent fire stations from closing and certain parks programs and recreation programs from closing down.
What if the city does not get concessions from the unions? Will there be more layoffs and service cuts?
Yes, there will. Right now, the way the budget's adopted, which assumes labor concessions, we will lay off right around 100-plus people. And that's mainly or all non-public safety. None of those layoffs are to police or fire. The problem will be if we don't get labor concessions, we'll have to lay off another 100 people. Now, we did extend the time to do those layoffs for a month to give us additional time to negotiate with the principal labor unions.
My guest is Steve Cohn, Sacramento City Councilman. Last night, the City Council approved the budget for the fiscal year starting July 1st. It closed a $43 million shortfall and includes 100 layoffs. And yet, despite the fact there was this huge shortfall, the city also approved money for the police department to start hiring 30 officers over the next 3 years. Where does that money come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. Where that came from was the sale of the Sheraton Hotel, which occurred several years ago, but we still had a little over $5 million left over from that. So that's obviously one-time money that we won't see again, but we felt this was an important time to use it. In a sense, it you can think of it as reserves because it was unallocated, and we still have about $10 million additional funds beyond that $5 million in reserves.
Why hadn't that money been already designated to something, given the severity of the budget crisis?
Well, because we need for reserves, you have to be very careful when you have a budget as large as ours, which it used to be $400 million plus. Now it's much less than that. But when you have that large a budget, you got to understand that's an estimate and a forecast. Things don't always come out either on the revenue side or the expense side exactly how you forecast. So you need to put in a little cushion, which we call reserves.
That Sheraton sale money, those are one-time funds. Are there other one-time funds that were used to plug this gap that could make next year's deficit worse?
Well, we were very conservative on this, and we have been over the years. That's one difference between the city council and, say, state government. Federal government, of course, they can print money, which we cannot do. State government, though, has really used smoke and mirrors in addition to one-time funds. We are very cautious about using one-time funds. And an example of where we did was, in addition to what I mentioned with the Sheraton, was we had a what's called a Park Special Revenue Fund of $1.4 million, which obviously by its name is intended to be used for parks. So we used half of that to defer closing down swimming pools and community centers and certain senior and youth programs that people were very concerned about. Another example where we had $1 million in an art stabilization fund, we used $150,000 of that to restore cuts to the Metro Arts Commission. So we were very strategic in terms of using the one-time funds. We didn't just use up our reserves.
Steve Cohn, Sacramento City Councilman. Last night, the City Council also discussed and voted on a procedural step for strong mayor. Mayor Kevin Johnson has been promoting for some time now, increasing the powers of the mayor. And last night, the mayor asked the City Council to direct the city attorney to draft a measure for the November ballot. But that was voted down 7-2. Let's listen to one of the City Council members who spoke last night. This is Rob Fong.
I don't think the case has been made that, A, there's something wrong with the current form of government. Now, there may well be, and I'm happy to have that discussion, but I want the public to have that discussion with us.
Steve Cohn, you voted alongside Rob Fong and most of the other council members against sending this proposal to the city attorney as part of the process of putting it on the November ballot. Why did you vote against doing that?
Well, you know, at this time, there's no consensus on the council on what should be in the charter revision. So given that we're not clear on what should be in it, certainly the mayor was clear on what he wanted in the proposal, but there was no consensus on the council. Frankly, there was not even a majority, let alone a simple majority, let alone a consensus. So there was no point in drafting language when it's clear that the council members don't agree on what should be in the charter change proposal. I think we need to come together and discuss this further and with the public. And I'm certainly still open to charter change. I said that in my comments last night. I think I disagree with both sides of this debate to some degree. I do believe there is a need for charter change, but I also don't believe that the mayor's proposal is the way to go. I think we need to hash this out further and come up with more of a hybrid system where the mayor and council do take more accountability and responsibility as opposed to the city manager, but not vest as much power as had been proposed in one person.
Before the session, Mayor Johnson predicted that he had the votes on the strong mayor measure. Clearly he didn't. Did he contact you before the session and ask how you would vote?
No, he never did. And I think that may be part of the problem is, you know, he may be relying a little bit too much on emissaries and go-betweens to ask for things. Now, of course, the Brown Act does make it difficult in that you can only talk to three other council members on any given item. So you have to be very strategic in terms of who you talk to and how you use those three. Other people can talk to other council members, but it, you know, so it's a little, it's a very difficult and sensitive way you have to go about getting votes for an important measure. And one thing I learned from Mayor Serna, though, when he was mayor, was you have to learn to count to five.
All this happened quite late last night. Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler was there, and he sent me an email this morning, and he said that when it became clear how the strong mayor vote was going to go, the mayor talked at great length, more than half an hour, and among his comments, he criticized you for not attending the recent vote on boycotting Arizona because of its controversial immigration law. How do you react to that?
Well, it didn't help him switch my vote, I can tell you that. As to the substance of the criticism, you know, I just got through walking precincts, knocking on thousands of doors in my district for reelection. I was the only incumbent to be reelected, and I heard loud and clear from my constituents, they did not want me spending time on the Arizona boycott issue. They want me paying attention to the budget and other critical items. So frankly, that's what I did. I am not spending any more time on this Arizona boycott issue.
Finally, the city council also last night moved forward on putting a measure on the November ballot that would increase fees paid within city limits charged to businesses and tax medical marijuana dispensaries. The city council has directed the city attorney to draft that measure. Business groups say that this runs the risk of sending businesses outside of the city. Are you concerned with that?
Well, yes, I am, and I can assure you we will not put something on the ballot that's going to drive businesses out of the city. So we've asked for different options to come back. Really what we're looking for is just a fairness. Right now you have large businesses that, because there's a $5,000 cap on the business fee, you have $50-100 million revenue operations paying the same tax as a small business. That's not fair and it's not right. We just need to correct our business operations tax, which has not been modified in 20 years, and bring it up to date, frankly. That's the main thing we want to do, and so we need to get that right, and we are concerned that we not do anything to hurt particularly small and medium-sized businesses. I think we'll get it right before we put that on the ballot. And the medical marijuana tax, I think most people agree, including the medical marijuana dispensaries, that there should be a tax. They should pay their fair share. So the only question is, what is the fair share? And yes, and we ask for different options come back, basically between 1.8 and 3% on the medical marijuana.
Steve Cohn, Sacramento City Councilman, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
By the way, we reached out to a total of five council members yesterday and today. Steve Cohn was the only one who was able and or willing to join us. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a California National Guard medic wins a Silver Star for heroism under fire in Afghanistan. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check out Insight on Facebook and click like. Today on Talk of the Nation, more primary election results and the weekly trivia question with NPR's political junkie Ken Rudin. Also, a beginner's guide to the U.S. Constitution. You'll need to get up to speed with next week's confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. A CHP officer who serves in the California National Guard now has a Silver Star, the third highest military award for bravery. Staff Sergeant Emmett Spractus of Dixon is a medic. He was honored for the heroism he showed while helping wounded U.S. soldiers under fire in Afghanistan. Spractus is the first California National Guardsman to receive a Silver Star while engaging the enemy in Afghanistan or Iraq. He joins us by phone. Emmett Spractus, welcome to Insight.
Jeffrey, good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. Last July 17th in Afghanistan, you and your crew responded to a distress call. Wounded soldiers were pinned down in a tough place. Could you describe the scene for us?
Well, they were in a very tight draw, and they were north of their base that they had come from. And they really stepped into a hornet's nest. There was a complex attack. There were small arms fire at their north, and then they were flanked on the right and left. And as it turns out, they ended up being surrounded. They had one soldier initially wounded, a critical injury. He was shot in the abdomen. One soldier, dodging rounds, fractured his ankle and was not able to move on his own horsepower. And another soldier was shot in the hip. And so they put out what we call a nine-line call, a call for a medevac.
But this was a very dangerous situation, not just for the soldiers who were wounded and pinned down, but also for anyone who came in to try and help them. What did you and your crew in the Black Hawk helicopter face trying to get there?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background. Really doctrine for medevac is that we go in and scoop up the soldiers and work on them once the area is pacified, for the most part. We decided as a crew, Sergeant Gifford, CW2 St. Aubin, and CW4 Erdman, and myself, that if we made the call and we asked the medic or the soldiers on the ground, will the soldier die if we don't come in? And if the answer came back yes, that we were going to go in anyway. And that was our mindset going in. And we knew when they made the call out, we can hear the intense gunfire on the radio. When we got close to the area, we can hear the intense of gunfire going on.
When the helicopter comes in, the helicopter, of course, has to slow down, and then you had to be dropped down. You could not move as quickly as combat soldiers would. How were you able to defend yourselves, if you were able to defend yourselves at all?
Well, this is what happens. We have cover ships. We had the 58 Sakayawas that are gunships, and they were doing strafing runs while we were going in. We had the soldiers on the ground giving us cover fire. You know, medevac is not armed. And so, you know, the individuals are assigned a rifle and a pistol. But when you're, you know, flying an aircraft or a crew chief or medic, they're really personal weapons more than anything. And so to kind of mitigate that, what we do is we do kind of an unusual, it's not used in the Army very much, it's called the combat hoist. And what that means is as we're approaching, they're lowering me down. So by the time I hit the ground, I unhook, give them the signal, and they peel off. And what that does is that really kind of limits our signature for the bad guys.
What was going through your mind just before you dropped out of the helicopter and as you were being pulled in?
Oh, well. Okay, so, you know, I can hear this intensive firefight going on. And, you know, we asked them to see, you know, if they can find a landing zone, what they call an HLZ, helicopter landing zone, for us. And you know, quite honestly, I haven't prayed a selfish prayer in years. You know, I pray for my friends, my family, and all that. But for the first time in years and years, I prayed a selfish prayer, and I'm a little ashamed of that. I prayed that we could find a helicopter landing zone so that I could run out and grab these guys and get out of there, because I really did not want to be dropped through that type of fire. And so the answer came back, which was no, you know, we can't, there's no place for you, no place to land. And so, you know, of course, I thought of my children, and I thought that probably, and to be quite honest with you, I'm not sure how we survived this. I really was convinced that I probably would not survive this, but I thought of my children, and then I thought, how could I look into the eyes of a parent of one of these boys down there and not go? I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I made my way over to the hoist. I got onto the hoist, and I was leaning out of the aircraft, and we unhooked from the intercom system, and I yelled to my crew chief. I said, tell my children I love them, because I really thought that this was, you know, the last communication, that up to that point, this is all my kids were going to know of me.
And you thought you would be killed.
I did. And you know, he looked back at me, and because we can't hear each other very, very well when we're not on the intercom system, he looked at me, and he kind of mouthed the words, you love me? And I said, no. You know, I'm yelling back at him, no, my kids. And at that point, I just said, oh, heck with it, you know. And we focused in on the mission. And at that point, Jeffrey, we you know, once you leave the aircraft, once you start to be hoisted down, then you really put your fate in God's hands. I mean, it's just there's not a lot you can do as a flight medic. You rely on your crew, you rely on your crew chief, you rely on the guys on the ground giving you cover fire in the 58s and the other helicopters burning holes in the ground, you know. But you're either going to make it or you're not. And I hit the ground and I started to work. Yeah, big relief.
My guest is Emmett Spractus. He's a staff sergeant in the California National Guard, recently received the Silver Star for his heroism in helping injured American soldiers while under fire in Afghanistan. He's also an officer and paramedic at the California Highway Patrol Academy. So what happened on the ground?
Well, what happened is I could see that it felt to me like they kind of lost a little bit of their momentum. You know, there were only 16 guys there, and they're a tight group. And you know, three of them were injured, one very seriously. And then as it turned out later, two of them had very serious, seriously dehydrated. I didn't know at the moment I hit the ground that they were out of water and they were extremely low on ammo. And so, you know, I just did my business. I evaluated the soldier. I determined that he needed the surgeon more than he needed me to work on him right away. So I packaged him up. Because of the battle kind of ebbed and flowed, we were fortunate that we were, from the time I hit the ground to the time we got him into the helicopter, was 10 minutes. And so what I did is I put him on a sked, which is a, you know, like a litter that you can hook up to the cable. Our aircraft came back in, dust off 2-4 with the crew. They dropped the cable. I hooked him up and I ran out and taglined him up. In other words, I hung on to a rope so that he didn't spin out of control when they hoisted him up. We were very close to Assadabad Ford surgical team. So it made sense. If they fly 3 minutes and get him there without me, as opposed to them having to do another turn, you know, 5, 10, maybe 20 minutes to come around and get me, depending on the flow of the battle. So I left him in the good hands of Sergeant Staff Sergeant Gifford and, of course, the pilots, Erdman and St. Aubin, and they took him to ABAD, and they came back again.
What happened to the others on the ground?
Well, you know, there was a little bit of a wait because of the way the firefight was going. And so, you know, I started distributing my ammo. I was directing the guys for fields of fire. We made an assessment of the two injuries. I hooked those guys up and got them prepared to be hoisted out as well. In the meantime, as the dust off 2-4 came back in, they saw the insurgents making their way toward us and directed cover fire successfully, kind of beating back the Taliban fighters. And so, which bought us some time. We were able to work a little bit. And we ended up hoisting those to, I call them kids. I mean, one of the things is that I knew what was down there. We all know what's down there. I'm 48 years old. I know these guys are like my son's age. And so, you know, they're like kids to me. So, you know, we hoisted these kids out of there and got them up in the aircraft. And dust off 2-4 made another turnout.
And then you got out, of course, at the end?
Well, I mean, it's we could talk for hours. No, what happened was I identified the two heat casualties, and they were very, very sick because, you know, we kind of organized, and I wanted to move to another location that was more defensible. And when I found out we had low ammo and no water, Dust Off 2-4 came back and dumped off a bunch of water in a very quick turn, very low, and a very courageous act on the crew's part. And that's why they got the Distinguished Flying Cross. They went into fire 6 times. And so they dropped off the water. We hydrated everybody. I cooled these guys down, and they came in for another hoist and hoisted the heat casualties out.
Once it was all over, how did you come back to normal state of mind?
Well, we're still working on that right now. You know, what do you mean? Like immediately post incident at the Ford surgical team?
Because this must have been an almost unimaginably stressful situation.
Yeah, it was. I mean, as far as time frames go, you know, depending on who you talk to, it was around an hour that we were in the middle of this intense thing. And you know, when I got back, when they hoisted me back up. I got into the aircraft, and I can tell you that I was physically and emotionally exhausted. I laid on my back, and I looked up at the ceiling of the helicopter, and I thought, I breathed a sigh of relief, and I thought, thank God, you know, we're out of here. And then I looked around, and I saw a whole bunch of extra people in the back of the aircraft, and I realized that a couple of patients were still in there. So I had to get back to work. So I had to reset my brain real quick. And then we got back to the Ford surgical team in Assadabad, and I did my turnover information. I checked on my first patient who was still being operated on. And as it turns out, I ended up our crew, us, we ended up flying him back to Jalalabad so that he could do further transport to Bagram for follow-on operations. So it was there was really no time at that point to kind of reset yourself, you know, to come down from it. Because I had to go from a medic and a fighter to a critical care transport guy once we got him, because he was on a vent. Medications were dripping. You know, he was sedated, paralyzed, pain management. He was opened up. You just really had to start thinking on the medical side of the house then.
Emmett Spractus of the California National Guard. What was it like when you heard that you were going to receive the Silver Star, which is obviously a prestigious military award?
Well, you know, I was stunned. Of course, I was honored. And, you know, and really thinking about this and really evaluating what I've done and what the crew did and what others did, and really what I feel personally is that I'm really the custodian of this thing, this award, this honor, because really all of our crews, so the phenomenal crew chiefs, pilots, maintainers, ops guys, the medics, any one of those guys in that situation from California, Nevada, and Wyoming, you know, National Guard that were with us could have done that job. And it just happened to be my turn. So what I'm telling you is it really, I feel like the custodian that really belongs to all of us.
Will you be going back to Afghanistan?
Oh, you know, the idea is that you do a tour in every 5 years, the way things go. But, you know, there is talk about maybe once every four, once every three. And I could retire in a few years. And so it's kind of a crapshoot. I don't see anything in the near future or medium future about that at all. I do want to say one thing to you. I'm very happy to do this interview. I didn't think I would be able to. As you've said it a few times, I'm a highway patrol officer, and we had a memorial service this morning for Officer Philip Ortiz, badge number 10428, who succumbed to a on-duty traffic collision yesterday. And I just wanted to throw out, you know, my prayers to his family. And you know, the highway patrol, my other family is kind of hurting right now.
Yes, I understand. Well, Emmett Spractus, staff sergeant in the California National Guard, also an officer and paramedic at the California Highway Patrol. He lives in Dixon. He recently was awarded the Silver Star, the third highest military award for bravery, for his heroism in helping injured American soldiers while under fire in Afghanistan. Emmett Spractus, congratulations on the Silver Star, and thank you so much for joining us today, and our best wishes to your colleagues at the California Highway Patrol.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, biocremation. Is it a greener way to dispose of remains? A bill would make it legal in California. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email is insight@capradio.org. Biocremation is touted as a natural and greener way to dispose of human remains. It uses a liquid chemical to speed up decomposition, but biocremation is not legal in California. A bill in the state legislature aims to change that. We're going to talk about that and biocremation more generally speaking. We'll start with Joe Sihe, founder and executive director of the Green Burial Council. Joe, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
What is biocremation? How does it work?
Well, biocremation is a form of carbonless cremation, essentially, where the body decomposes with the help of some chemicals. And much like conventional cremation, where a chemical process reduces the body to bone shards, the decedent is essentially reduced to what is a bone shadow, and then that is pulverized in a similar manner or reduced to ashes that a family can then dispose of as they see fit.
You said it's a carbon.
There are some real
Yeah. You said it's a carbonless cremation, but isn't the human body made up to a great extent of carbon? How can you decompose it without liberating, if that's the right word, carbon?
Well, and I'm not the expert on biocremation, just so you know, and our organization doesn't certify cremation programs, as it were. We are involved with cremation disposition programs. We have yet to get involved with this idea. But it does offer some environmental benefits. Obviously, there's no CO2 emitted. Mercury is fully mitigated, which can't take place with conventional cremation. But through the process, which has been used, as you may know, at the Mayo Clinic and some other places, there is a effluent that can be disposed of through the sewage system, and it renders the decedent into a byproduct that is non-toxic and biodegradable.
I'm talking with Joe Sihe of the Green Burial Council. How common is biocremation? Is it practiced much elsewhere?
The process hasn't been really utilized commercially. It was used at the Mayo Clinic, where it was really developed, and I understand it's been used at some research facilities with animals for quite some time, too. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of new alternative modes of disposition in the coming years. This is just the first one to come on the market.
What's the problem with conventional cremation from your point of view?
Well, we really don't think anything's wrong with any mode of disposition or mode of body prep or option for memorialization. The council has been very careful not to diminish any of them. This is very sensitive subject matter, but for people who want to live and die with a lighter hand on the land, the big issue is CO2 and mercury pollution. We actually hired an environmental planning firm a couple of years ago to help us set up an offset program, and they determined that the typical cremation creates enough CO2 to require about a $4 contribution to a carbon fund. And in fact, they got back to us and said, boy, you know, you might be making a mountain out of a molehill, thinking about comparing this to what we do in our daily lives, heating and cooling our homes and driving our cars. But that $4, that minimal amount of cremation, the carbon emission, does matter to some families. And so they want a greener way of cremating their loved ones, and they should have that option, we believe. I think every aspect of death care has some environmental impact, obviously, and cremation is no different from that. But I think it's been badly diminished by some environmentalists.
Mm. We're focusing on biocremation, but just give us a quick idea of some other, quote-unquote, green ways of handling human remains.
Well, the greenest way is a whole-body green burial that does not take place with embalming and with a burial vault. Right now in this country, we're putting about 826,000 gallons of formaldehyde-based embalming fluid into the ground, and 1.6 million tons of reinforced concrete via burial vaults with a great deal of embodied energy in that. Caskets also have a big carbon footprint. I calculated the other day that we bury enough caskets each year to rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge, enough metal in caskets. So with green burial, the most environmentally friendly way to go is to do a shallow body, a shallower grave, so there's not methane produced from the body. And a shroud or simple wooden casket is far better than a metal casket, vaultless. And again, if it's done correctly, that burial ground can actually be part of an effort to facilitate ecological restoration and or landscape level conservation. That's the greenest way to go. But there are many shades of green, and you know, families are balancing a lot of things here: how much they want to pay, what this burial process actually looks like or products look like, and the environmental benefits, which can vary greatly.
The bill in the California legislature, AB 2283, would make biocremation legal in California. Is it hard, in your experience, to make the case to make other forms, quote-unquote green forms, of disposing of human remains legal?
Well, I think that they're going to be...
Or just to accept them, just for general acceptance.
Well, that's a whole different issue. I think that for some, there's an ick factor that people are going to have to get beyond, just as they had to get beyond the idea of incinerating a loved one a couple decades ago. You know, for many, that was just something that was not dignified or decent, and we've come to accept it. So I think the same thing will happen here. But I'm very pleased that the legislature is actually exploring this. Our concern, quite frankly, has been that there are a number of claims about green everything these days, not just in the funeral service industry, that can't be backed up. There's a lack of regulatory oversight. We have third-party trust providers like the Green Burial Council out there trying to provide some stopgap governance. But quite frankly, I saw the other day where a burial vault manufacturer was making claims about burial vaults being green because they're made from, as the manufacturer put it, the basic elements of Earth. I thought, yeah, much like plutonium. But there are no real legitimate environmental benefits coming out of that product. And the same is true with a lot of other claims. Here, I think there's some legitimate environmental benefits. There's certainly a reduction of CO2. There's certainly an elimination of mercury pollution, which for a number of several more years is going to be an issue. There are no cost-effective ways of mitigating mercury pollution through conventional cremation. And if that matters to you and your family, now you have an alternative.
We've been talking about biocremation, otherwise known as alkaline hydrolysis. It's another way of cremating the human body using a liquid chemical to speed up decomposition of the body. There's a bill in the California legislature, AB 2283, that would make this process legal in California. We had hoped to speak with the assemblyman, Jeff Miller, who authored the bill, but that's not going to happen. So we will now thank Joe Sihe, founder and executive director of the Green Burial Council, for joining us. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Cronus Quartet comes to Grass Valley to celebrate Nevada County composer Terry Riley. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more about the people and topics in our show, go to capradio.org/insight. One of the world's most famous modern classical groups is coming to the foothills this week to help celebrate a birthday. It's the Cronus Quartet, playing at Music in the Mountains in Grass Valley on Thursday. All the music they'll play was written by Terry Riley, the Nevada County composer who's celebrating his 75th birthday. Riley is best known for working in the music genre called minimalist. Joining us is David Harrington, violinist and founder of Cronus Quartet. David Harrington, welcome to Insight.
It's great to be here.
The Cronus Quartet and Terry Riley go back a long way. How far back?
Well, Terry has been writing for Cronus for the last 30 years. And in that time, he's written 26 new pieces for us. And as far as I'm concerned, every one of them sounds just as fresh today as ever. And he's one of our country's greatest composers, and as far as I'm concerned, just a wonderful, powerful force in creative musical thinking.
26 new pieces over 30 years for Cronus Quartet. Obviously, the Cronus Quartet likes what they're getting from Terry Riley. Could you describe his music for us? What is it that makes it work so well for you and for others?
You know, there's always a sense of exploration in Terry Riley's music, and a sense of kind of connection, connecting musical ideas throughout the world, really. His many of his pieces draw on musical colors and rhythms and thinking from lots of different traditions. And I think that Terry's creative life has been one of exploration of all kinds of different ways of approaching music. And I hope that there will be at least 26 more new pieces in the next 30 years. And I know I remember in 25 years ago, we celebrated Terry's 50th birthday at the Great American Music Hall. And it really doesn't seem like it was 25 years ago.
I bet.
It seems like it was a few weeks ago. So time plays tricks.
David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet, which is playing in Grass Valley tomorrow night. It's a concert celebrating the 75th birthday of Nevada County composer Terry Riley. It happens at the Amaral Center at the Nevada County Fairgrounds. It's part of the Music in the Mountains Summerfest. What's Terry Riley like to work with? I'm sure you've spent a lot of time with him over the years.
Terry is one of my closest and dearest friends, and every time he's at a Kronos rehearsal, it feels so fun and natural and thrilling. He's someone who writes music, but then rarely it feels like he needs to control it. It's kind of like, for him, I believe writing music is a way of kind of relating to the world of musicians and audiences. There's always more than one way Terry's music can be played. And he'd be the first one to say that. So as far as I'm concerned, working with Terry is kind of it's a voyage. It's a way of beginning to think about things.
Terry Riley's music genre is generally called minimalist. What does that mean?
I don't know what that means. There's a lot of people that use that word and seem to know what they're talking about, and I really don't. I mean, almost everybody that is labeled that by the music press Kronos has worked with at one time or another, and so if you're talking about Terry Riley and Philip Glass and Steve Reich and John Adams,
it's very different
and
music.
Morton Feldman and Lamont Young and people like that. I find these composers totally different, and if we're thinking about getting back to basics and kind of examining music in a way that is kind of very American, then I'd say maybe that's what the way I think of Terry Riley.
David Harrington, violinist and founder of Kronos Quartet, which is playing in Grass Valley tomorrow night in honor of Nevada County composer Terry Riley. I'm looking at the pieces that Kronos is playing tomorrow night, all written by Terry Riley over the years for the quartet. The Welcoming Baptism of Sweet Daisy Grace, Conquest of the War Demon, and Transylvanian Horn Courtship. These are all very unusual titles.
Well, Terry Riley is a poet in so many ways, and this Sweet Daisy Grace, the Welcoming Baptism of Sweet Daisy Grace, is a piece that he wrote in honor of his granddaughter's birth. And Conquest of the War Demons is an absolutely incredible piece from a much larger piece called Salome Dances for Peace. And it's definitely a major statement about the desire for peace in the world, and the conquest of the war demons is it's right at the center of that.
Yes.
And Transylvanian Horn Courtship is a recent work that Terry wrote for us that uses some really unusual instruments. And these instruments were specially made for this piece. And can't wait to play it. It's so beautiful and unusual and wonderful.
One thing I've read about Terry O'Reilly, it's kind of an odd fact, assuming it's true, and that is that Pete Townsend named the song Baba O'Reilly, the Who song, partly in reference to Terry O'Reilly. Is that true, and why would that be?
He named it definitely in reference to Terry, and, well, Pete Townsend, among many other musicians around the world, have been influenced by Terry's music and his incredible creativity. And, you know, there's, in fact, the number of musicians that have been influenced by Terry's work is almost incalculable at this point. And the thing is that he is so modest, and he doesn't have a press office or a machine behind him. And so a lot of people just don't know his influence and his renown, but he's one of our greatest, absolutely.
So the pieces you're playing tomorrow have been written in the past. Do you have any more commissions coming from Terry O'Reilly?
You know, that's one thing that Terry and I are going to be talking about tomorrow before and after the concert. So I think the short answer is yes, and we're figuring it out.
That's great. David Harrington, a violinist and founder of the Kronos Quartet, which is playing in Grass Valley tomorrow night. It's part of Music in the Mountains Summer Fest. It's at 7:30 at the Amaral Center at the Nevada County Fairgrounds. It's a concert celebrating the 75th birthday of Nevada County composer Terry O'Reilly, who's long worked with Kronos Quartet, and all the pieces on the program were written by Terry O'Reilly for Kronos Quartet. David Harrington, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Sosin Morar, and Natalie Rothfels. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Should oiled birds be cleaned? A UC Davis biologist has been studying the effect of oil in birds for the last 20 years. On the next Insight, we'll talk to him about what he's discovered, and we'll check in on animal rescue operations in the Gulf of Mexico. Also, how is the top two open primary working in Washington State? Plus, Sacramento musician Douglas Newton releases his first CD and more sound advice. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.